Hello. On Sit Rep this week, we have a strange array of weapons to discuss. From North Korea, balloons carrying bags of rubbish and excrement. From South Korea, loudspeakers blaring K-pop so loud it can be heard for miles around. So what is it with these childish-sounding border tactics between two countries who are still technically at war? Also, a far more serious weapon from Ukraine, a drone, which they hope could target individual people by using AI to recognize their voices. And we'll hear from a former RAF officer with tales of honey traps, fake firefighters, and a brown bear in the middle of Moscow, all from his time spying on the Kremlin.
Sit Rep
with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So, Mike, let's start by talking about why we're seeing this war of the playground at the Korean border. For anyone who hasn't heard, what on earth is going on here?
Yes, I mean, this began a little while ago when South Korean activists were using balloons, which had been used many times before, to send over the border into the north leaflets and some USB sticks of pop music, which the North Koreans had banned. And remember, the North Koreans ban all sorts of things that they think are Western influences. I mean, last December, just before Christmas, they banned laughter for 11 days because
Incredible.
It was the 10th anniversary of Kim Jong-il's death. For that reason, laughter and shopping and drinking alcohol was banned for 11 days. So they ban anything. And private groups in the South tried to counteract this. And then in this case, the North Koreans are counteracting it themselves with sending balloons of rubbish over to the South, partly as an insult, but also as a way of hitting back. And in response, the South have now gone back to setting up loudspeakers, which broadcast material into the North. So this is an uptick in the sort of thing that's been going on for many, many years between North and South.
Well, with us on Sit Rep is Robert Kelly, Professor of Political Science at Pusan National University in South Korea. Robert, welcome to Sit Rep. You're 200 or so miles from the border, aren't you? Any sign of these rubbish balloons where you are?
No, they don't make it far enough down here. The North Koreans, you know, probably aren't going to put the resources into it to actually put like a motor on any of these things, right? No, that's all up happening near the DMZ. I'm much further in the south.
We're talking about two heavily armed countries. You explained to us last year that they're still technically at war. If they wanted to actually fight, they could have one, couldn't they? So why seemingly such petty tactics?
Yeah, these sorts of things happen a lot with the North Koreans and the South Koreans. So if you take the demilitarized zone tour, for example, if you ever come to South Korea, they'll take you to a place where the two Koreas built like competing flag towers, right? Like one after another. And the North Koreans insisted on building the highest flag tower in the world. And, you know, whatever, everybody takes a picture of it. And it's like, I don't know, it's like half a mile high. I mean, sure, why not, right? But I mean, it comes back to your point, right? Sort of playground war or whatever. And I think it's really because the two Koreas are trapped in such a tight zero-sum legitimacy contest that they feel like if they give on anything, right, that somehow sort of losing because the two Koreas make, you know, directly competing overlapping claims to control the peninsula, right? They both claim that they're the sovereign government of the entire peninsula, that the other's being manipulated by foreigners and stuff like that. And so this kind of stuff, this goes back to the Cold War, these sorts of tit for tat little cycles. I don't actually think this one means too much, right? But I think the reason why people are paying attention to it is one is because it does seem so petty, and two, because the North Koreans are, you know, putting manure in these things and everything else, and it's pretty foul, right? Which really kind of tells you a little bit about the North Korean regime, right? I mean, it tells you the way the North Koreans think about international politics, which is that they can just do whatever they want, right? I mean, that to me is a really striking thing, right? And this is just North Korea acting out, right? This is the same kind of mentality about how they just don't have any kind of responsibility and they can just do whatever they want, right? And you see that here just as well as you see it when they go and assassinate somebody overseas.
But Robert, you know, blaring out K-pop, that seems pretty petty as well.
Yeah, there is an argument for that, though. I'll actually defend this because I know some of the defector groups that like do the balloons and stuff.
So there's two-way balloon traffic, right?
Yeah, I guess you could call it that. I hadn't thought of it. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. And the argument is, and I agree with it, that we want to pierce the information cordon around North Korea. We want to get information in there. We want to sort of tell North Koreans, regular North Koreans, that South Korea is different. It's better. It's open. It's free. You can do whatever you want. You can listen to K-pop. You can enjoy BTS or whatever the latest groups are and stuff like that. And so I am actually quite sympathetic to the idea of the balloon launches. And if the best the North Koreans can do is drop trash on us in response, I would argue that that's an exchange we should be willing to make. But I'm not a South Korean, of course. This has been kind of controversial in South Korea. But, you know, South Korea is a constant, it's a liberal democracy, right? I mean, it's kind of awkward when the Korean government comes and tells people they can't engage in freedom of action and freedom of speech. And this has sort of been a constitutional issue in South Korea for a while, right? Are they allowed to do this or not? Because it has these weird international effects. But I mean, in principle, people are allowed to release balloons in a free society, right? So it's a little constitutionally awkward.
Mike, to what extent is this is basically old-fashioned psychological warfare going on here?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's very similar to the sort of things that go on between China and Taiwan and have done for years. It used to go on between East and West Germany. And I saw it myself many times. And it's all about precedence. If you allow something to go unchallenged, the other side will say, oh, it's a precedent. You've not challenged it. So you accept our legitimacy to do what you didn't respond to. And so everything has to have a response. Otherwise, the other side will claim that they have a precedent for carrying on doing it. And that's why, right up to the biggest level, like military exercises and military confrontations, down to the smallest level, like throwing leaflets at each other, is all a competition in maintaining the status quo and establishing that the other side does not have a precedent to step over the line. So that it seems childish, but there is a political reason behind it.
And what kind of examples can you give us, Mike, from East and West Germany?
Oh, East and West Germany. I participated myself in as a visitor in the flag tours. And so the Western vehicles were allowed to go into Eastern Germany, military vehicles, and the East Germans would always follow it around and sometimes collide with it and bump it from the back as if there was an accident. And the same would happen with Russian vehicles and going into West Berlin. I also, in Kinmen, the offshore island of China, it's a Taiwanese island, used to be called Quemoy and Matsu, the two little islands that are within sight of China, the Chinese mainland. And I have a knife, a kitchen knife, that was made for me in Kinmen while I stood and watched out of the shell casings because for years, the Chinese and the Taiwanese bombarded each other. And the Chinese used to bombard them on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays.
Yeah, that's right.
The Taiwanese would hit back on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays with shells, which were full of leaflets. And these shells in Kinmen are now piled up, thousands of them. And every now and again, when visitors come around, they cut a piece of a shell out and they're in front of your eyes. They make a kitchen knife for you and inscribe your name on it and give you in about a quarter an hour a completed knife, which is made out of a Chinese shell casing fired on a Tuesday, a Thursday or a Saturday over from the mainland to Kinmen. And it was going on for year after year after year in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I forgot about that story of the two of them sort of exchanging fire. Yeah, I think the larger issue, right, is that whether or not, at least in the Korean cases, whether or not these sorts of tit-for-tat things might sort of spiral out of control or something like that, or if they take place in areas where are more militarily sensitive. So, for example, like in the Yellow Sea, right, you have North Korean fishing boats crossing over, and so the South Koreans chase them around and stuff like that. And so there you always have the possibility, right, where the two sides are prodding each other, as Mr. Clark said, trying to set precedents, where if the other side pushes back, you could, in fact, have, you know, sort of an incident where things spin out of control. There have been shootouts in the Yellow Sea in the past and stuff like that. There have been armed incidents at the DMZ in the past, right? One of the things I always wonder about, I think one of the things people are concerned about with the return of the loudspeakers is that maybe one of these days the North Koreans might shell one of them. That's never happened before. That would be pretty risky, right? But, you know, the North Koreans are prone to these sorts of things, right? We know the North Koreans have assassinated people overseas. We know the North Koreans have fired on South Korean positions in the past and stuff like that. And so when you read people talking about, is this going to spin out of control? That, if I had to sort of identify one possible flashpoint,
it's the music. It's the music that would trigger it.
Yeah, the loudspeakers actually really upset the North Koreans from what I've read, right? I mean, we don't know too much about how they make decisions, of course, but the North Koreans complain a lot about the loudspeakers, right? And you wonder sometimes, right? I mean, would they actually take action? But I mean, we just don't know. But if they did, that would actually be a genuine crisis.
Robert, shots were fired at the demilitarized zone in the last few days, weren't they, when the border was crossed?
Yeah, I don't know too much about that. That hasn't actually been in the South Korean news too much. The DMZ is 2 miles wide, and right in the middle of it is something called the military demarcation line. And so there's sort of concern that the North Koreans sort of going over the exact border and stuff like that. And so the South Korean government, the conservative government, is probably going to push back on that, right? Renewed tension at the DMZ is in part because you now have a more hawkish conservative government here in South Korea, which is less willing to sort of agree to terms that it saw as disadvantageous and in these military agreements. And that's one of the reasons why you're also getting the balloons, because the South Korean government, the conservative government, is more tolerant of this and doesn't want to crack down on these activists.
And Mike, is there actually anything vaguely strategic going on here with this tit for tat?
No, only in the terms of maintenance of the established relationship. And as Robert says, it can escalate quite quickly if somebody, as it were, breaks these tacit rules. Always the danger, the strategic issue, is not that it's strategically important in itself, but that it can always lead to a miscalculation. That's the problem.
Robert, you mentioned that possibility of that North Koreans take a pop at the speakers. I mean, how great really is the danger of escalation?
So I don't think the North Koreans are that reckless. They're a little bit reckless because they want us to be scared, but they're not extremely reckless, right? They're not Al-Qaeda. They're not going to go and risk a war. If they were going to start a war, they could have done it back in the 1970s, and they still had an advantage. If they're going to use nuclear weapons, they could have done it 15 years ago. So I don't actually think the North Koreans want that. I think the real problem is that if you get a crisis and things sort of like, you get like a tit-for-tat escalation, right? Sort of like, for example, in 2010, the North Koreans did some pretty nasty stuff, and the South Koreans actually wanted to bomb a North Korean harbor in response. U.S. Forces commander here told the South Korean government president, you know, if you do this, we don't know where it's going to go, right? If you get into that kind of tit-for-tat escalation spiral, that's a real problem, because I think crisis stability in Korea is really poor, because the two sides have very, very strong incentives to move first. Both sides are really vulnerable to the other. North Korea's nuclear weapons are very vulnerable to a counterforce first strike by us. South Korea's cities are very few and they're very concentrated, so it's to North Korea's advantage to launch its weapons first, right? So if we actually had something like the July 1914 crisis or the Cuban Missile Crisis here, right, there are really strong incentives for both sides to act first. So to my concern is not day-to-day deterrence in Korea. I actually think it's pretty stable. I mean, if you look around, there's lots of like foreign investment here, you know, like Nike or whatever doesn't think there's about to be a war. They wouldn't be here, right? The real concern, I think, is you got a crisis and then things spin out of control and you have these massive first use incentives on both sides. It's crisis instability, I think, that's the problem here, not day-to-day deterrence, right? Both sides are so vulnerable. There are massive incentives to move first that they think there's going to be a war, right? Which is like, you know, it's like July 1914 in Europe, by the way.
Robert Kelly, it's so good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Mike, there's a well-worn phrase, border skirmish, and we've got another regular example between India and China. Troops there have been seen fighting with wooden clubs and bricks in recent years. Why fight at a border if you don't want to go the whole hog?
Yeah, it's rather for the same reasons, Kate, that, I mean, they did go to war in 1962 over the border. And this border, remember, is that very high. It's in the Himalayas. And so, I mean, one part of the disputed area is in that border between Kashmir, Tibet and Xinjiang province in China. And then the other big one is the northwest part of the frontier, that what's known as the McMahon line. And these are very inhospitable areas. And so literally troops, you know, up there find it very difficult just moving around, let alone fighting. And any fighting that goes on up at that height is very, very specialized. And so going to war at that height is a very big undertaking. However, both sides want to defend their territory. They are disputed territories. The Indians are much more edgy about it now than they ever used to be since the war of 1962, really, because they feel that the Chinese are prepared to push. But yes, they scuffle, which is effectively what they do. They don't want to cause major number of deaths and provoke incidents, which would lead to another border war. But they don't want to give an inch of legitimacy to the other side to step over the line. So, you know, these clashes, scuffles go on continuously, and they've ramped up a lot in the last couple of years.
And Mike, what about the UK? Is there any history of this kind of childish tactic behaviour we're seeing on the Korean Peninsula in the UK?
We've never had that problem. I mean, we have sort of precedence issues, as with Gibraltar, the question of the airfield or the airport of Gibraltar, you know, where the road goes across it and there's like a level crossing. It has to come down every time an aircraft comes in that traffic is holed up, which otherwise has to cross the runway. And that's all about precedence. And so there's a lot of issues there, which are not dissimilar. They're not quite as sort of comical as some of these others we've discussed, but they're very important for the same sort of reasons. And similar things around the Falkland Islands, not so much recently, but going back a long way, the ability the Falkland Islands to protect its economic zone, which of course could be, nobody's entirely sure, but could be very valuable, not just in fisheries terms, but in terms of hydrocarbons as well, although that's still not absolutely established, but it's quite likely. And so there's some elements there, but those are the two main areas where we have precedence issues. We do have actually a lot of disputed borders around the British Isles. The British Isles are very extensive, more than 1,000 islands in the British Isles, and there are quite a lot of disputed borders, but they're all disputed at a very diplomatic level, and nobody's going to get too excited about them because not many people live there.
Well, let's now turn our attention to Ukraine. And it's easy to forget that amid all the discussion about the UK, the US and other NATO allies supplying weapons, Ukraine itself is working hard to arm its forces. Little more than a decade ago, it was the world's fourth largest weapons exporter. Ukraine's Brave One Defense Innovation Group has just given an insight into the sum of the military technologies that it's working on at the first NATO-Ukraine Defense Innovators Forum in Poland. Olivia Savage, a senior journalist for Jane's, was at the forum.
Brave One were mentioning how they are currently developing acoustic sensors that they fit to UAVs, which are able to detect and hone in on specific individuals' voices and tanks, in order to, again, engage and destroy them to evade electronic warfare.
So you could actually select an individual that you want to target?
Apparently, this is how they described it, the acoustic sensor could detect specific individuals' voices and find them and engage and destroy, I suppose. They gave an example of a war criminal, which it had been successfully eliminated using this method.
So it's already been used?
Early days, but yes, I imagine given the war, any technology will hit the battlefield relatively early on to test. So in this instance, it was deployed, but I don't know at what scale. I would say probably pretty nascent still.
And specifically, the article on the Jane's website, it mentions loitering munitions.
Yeah, so Brave One briefly mentioned a number of AI development projects that their companies have been working on, and one of which are developing an alternative to Russia's loitering munition. They were pretty quiet on what that would involve for obvious reasons, but they did say that it's in the preliminary design testing stage. They also detailed some other AI technology programs, which are quite interesting because typically other militaries are very, very nervous about discussing what this involves, what they're doing. But in Ukraine, of course, the imperative is to deliver effect. So they've been developing UAV, actually they're deploying these, UAV-assisted AI drones that essentially the operator selects a target, and then the drone, about 500 meters to 1,000 meters out of the intended target, can then autonomously navigate and engage that objective or tank, for instance. So the point being is to evade Russian jamming, which typically works around 500 meters to 1,000 meters out. I spoke to a Ukrainian drone commander about 4 months ago about this, and they said that it was very nascent technology and now it's already deployed in the battlefield. So it definitely highlights how fast-paced and rapid technology is advancing at the moment.
I understand that you actually got to see a demonstration of one of the AI-enabled drones.
Well, it was just a pretty rudimentary small drone, to be honest, that they built for the event, and an operator flew it up above all of us, and then the operator selected the target, which at the time was just a Polish Jeep, and then it navigated autonomously to the vehicle, and then the operator quickly overrode it, so obviously it wouldn't hit into the Jeep, which it obviously intended would normally do. One time it did hit a branch, though, so we saw it a number of times doing this, but it did hit a branch at once, which sort of threw it off a bit.
And did you get a sense from the people that you spoke to how much of a difference those AI-enabled drones were making on the battlefield?
No, I think it's still it's not exactly robust technology yet. So actually at the NATO forum, part of it was something called a hackathon that was focusing on refining this exact technology, improving it, improving vehicle identification, for example. So I think it's still relatively nascent, but it is being deployed on the battlefield as we speak.
I know you said that this is very early days to really know exactly how much of a difference this can make on the battlefield, but how much excitement was there about it?
Yeah, I think there was quite a lot of excitement. I mean, there weren't that many media people there. When we were at the hackathon, it was mostly all the coders, which include people from Ukraine, working on it. So I think they were mostly focusing on their technologies because it was, at the end of the day, a hackathon and they wanted to win their prize. But I think what overall, having attended the forum for 2 days, Russian electronic warfare was repeatedly mentioned as a real sort of hampering Ukraine's operational effect, to be honest, and the importance of Ukraine developing their own electronic warfare capabilities and ways to evade that. So I think, to answer your question, I would say this is one element of what Ukraine is doing to try and evade Russian jamming. But to be fair, Russia, I know, is also deploying this technology. So, you know, whether it cancels each other out, perhaps.
Did you get any sense from that forum as to who was more advanced in this technology at the moment?
No one mentioned that. All I know is from a previous discussion with the Ukrainian drone commander, he said that they can see that Russians are also doing it.
So it's a technology race then?
Exactly. Yes. And I think for me, the electronic warfare aspect was very interesting to find out actually how capable Russia's systems are and how much they're affecting Ukraine. Because Natalia, from the head of Brave One, mentioned that like electronic warfare is the priority at the moment for developers in Ukraine.
Olivia Savage, really good to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mike, drones that can identify their designated target based on a voice, it sounds like a grey area right on the edge of human control and almost in the realm of killer robots.
Yeah, it's where we're moving to quite rapidly now, Kate. I mean, drones themselves, you know, it's quite an old technology if you think about it. I mean, V1s, the doodlebugs of 1944, were the first real drone weapons, and we've lived with them for quite a long time. But two things have happened in recent years which are really important. One is the sheer number and ubiquity of drones. They don't now have to be big. They can be very small. I mean, smaller than a quadcopter. And so we're talking about the use of drones, not in the dozens or even the hundreds, but now they're already being used in the tens of thousands. It's thought that on any given day in Ukraine, there's up to 10,000 drones in the air somewhere along the 600-mile front. And so we'll soon be talking about hundreds of thousands of drones on the front line and maybe several hundred, you know, half a million drones. And at the moment, most drones require one person to operate them. So they don't save lots of manpower, but they will because, I mean, that's what Olivia was really talking about. We're on the verge of the AI revolution. I mean, if you think about what drones might be able to achieve and link them to AI, then that really is a battlefield revolution. And we're just on the cusp of that revolution, where drones can become autonomous weapon systems of enormous power. Now, the point about autonomous systems is that there has to be a human in the loop somewhere. A human being has to take responsibility for whatever destruction is meted out in a certain part of the battle area, whatever it is. There has to be a person in the loop. But that person might be quite a long way back. And that person might be controlling a pretty large area in which, you know, several hundred or several thousand drones are operating, picking their own targets according to an algorithm or algorithms that have been given to them already. That's very challenging in terms of ethical considerations. But my goodness, it's challenging in terms of warfare as well. And I really think we're on the verge of a genuine battlefield revolution, not because of drones, but because of drones linked to the capabilities of artificial intelligence.
And it's really interesting that while we're sitting on the verge of this revolution, that the Ukrainians are actually trying out these cutting-edge technologies on the battlefield while they're still being developed.
Yeah, always happens in war that there isn't time to do a full testing program, so you test something on the battlefield. And of course, if you're wrong, it costs the lives of your people. You know, it can be, failure is very, very destructive and very, very hurtful. But that's still better to take something that's only half tested and perfect it in operations than to wait until it's been through a usual peacetime testing, and safety first is the most important element. That isn't the case in war. So warfare always enhances the development of possible technologies, and some of them emerge successfully, some of them don't. And you know, in this respect, the Ukrainians have got an advantage over the Russians, because although the Russians are technically very, very competent, the Ukrainians are actually more flexible in the way they operate. They've got a lot more youthful expertise to draw on, and they've got a big electronics and arms industry that goes back for many years that they can pull from. So if the Ukrainians can, as it were, survive into the next year or so, my guess is that they may find themselves technologically ahead of the Russians in some key areas. And one key area, I will guess, is going to be AI-controlled drones, both on their own for their own benefit and also in collaboration with their Western backers.
It's absolutely fascinating. I'm sure we're going to return to this. Now, around the world, there are hundreds of British servicemen and women working in embassies. A far reach from the frontline fighting, it typifies how varied a military career can be. But as the saying goes, your experience may vary depending on time and location. Well, Mike Murtagh got one of the most interesting ones, Russia in the mid-90s after the collapse of the Soviet Union. His career as an RAF officer had already taken in admin, recruiting, linguistics, and signals intelligence. His final posting was to the defense section of the UK's embassy in Moscow, where he later became a civilian security officer. His new memoirs is called Spying on the Kremlin, and he's been sharing some of his stories with me.
My main job was supervising the running of the office and our activities within that environment. In the section, we all got involved in certain sort of activities inside and outside the office there, where we would work with the Russians, improving relations, hopefully, but also getting on with keeping an eye on them as they kept an eye on us. We were dealing with the activities and policies of the Russians as we perceived them and feeding it all back to London in MOD, where their particular people would run with it and see what could be done. We had to be very careful at home as well, at all times, actually, because you were under constant surveillance. We had to assume all the flats were bugged. I mean, one time, my predecessor, his wife was coming out of the bath and somebody was coming in the front door. And he sort of held his hands up and went, whoops, sorry. They thought there was nobody in there. They would routinely break into our flats, you see. Not break in as such, they all had keys. And move things around, stuff like that.
So who was that broke into your friend's flat? Who was it?
Oh, that would be the FSB. They would do it in our flats. I mean, one time I had I think it was a DVD or a CD or something like that, and I'd left it in a particular place. I knew where I'd left it, and when I came home one day, it had gone. So I was a bit angry about it at the time, and some of the guys in work said, oh, talk to the wall about it. So I went back to the flat, and I stood in the middle of the room, and I said, where's my bloody DVD? And next day, there it was. Back again.
Came back.
So, yeah. So it was that sort of thing. It was a bit of a game, you know.
One of the incidents, interestingly, Mike, you write about is this fire at the embassy so-called firefighters arriving suspiciously early. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. This is sort of off the back of an American experience. The Americans had been similarly, a couple of years before, they'd been building a new embassy, and they'd had an incident where there was a fire. The firemen turned up and actually worked their way through the classified area and perpetrated a bit of mischief. So when something similar cropped up during the construction of the new British embassy, where I was a security officer, the sort of antennae went up.
What happened exactly?
Yeah, for about 2 weeks, this pile of rubbish had been accumulating at one corner of the site. The thing caught fire and we had to deal with it. And considering that I was not aware that we had called the fire brigade, there was suddenly a whole load of firemen outside, some of whom were right in front of me changing into firemen uniforms. And all these uniforms were really pristine, you know. It was quite strange and odd thing for them to do. There was one guy who was off to one side He had officer shoulder boards on, but he was in this scruffy uniform. And I asked him about some of these people, you know, particularly the guy who's obviously leading it. And he just sort of rolled his eyes and snorted, you know. But I was aware of his American story, and so there was no chance I was going to let them in. So
basically, it was a bit of a pantomime attempt to get access to the British Embassy to see what there was in terms of intelligence to gather, right?
Oh, pantomime flat, is it? Honestly.
Seriously?
it was beyond ridiculous, you know.
So you were, though, the target of a couple of honey trap operations, weren't you?
Yeah.
What happened?
I'd had enough time there to know that they were going to try something. They were going to try and compromise me because they knew that I was joining the Foreign Office. Over the time that I'd spent as a security officer, I've developed a sort of friendly, I mean, totally platonic, chatty relationship with a woman who used to clean the rooms in our apartment hotel thing that they put us in, Sonia. And one day, Sonia came in and she said, Oh, my friend wants to meet you. And I said, really? I thought, oh, God, here it comes. So anyway, yeah, a couple of days later, door knocks. I go and answer the door. And there's Sonia looking very sheepish with this other woman who, astonishingly, I think, have you ever seen From Russia with Love? You got the Rosa Klebb character, right?
Yeah.
Right. And she looked like her. She just stood there with her hands on her hips and suggested that the three of us actually get down
to it.
Yeah, that's it. right then and there. And I thought, oh, well, that's not very subtle. So I said, oh, gosh, you know, I'd love to, and I think it's a great idea, love to, but I've got to go to work now, and gosh, look at the time, I bet off I go. And they must have thought I was a pushover. But anyway, there was a sort of a darker side to this where I'll think that Sonia might have been coerced into cooperating there. Because as I said, her whole manner indicated she wasn't a sort of professional at this. Yeah.
Oh, when you step back, how does your time in the RAF in the UK and in Germany compare to your time in Moscow?
Whoa. Wow. Moscow was easily the most exciting and eventful. The rest of the experience in the RAF was rather patchy. A place like Odeum in those days in the 80s was extremely interesting for me. I had a lot of opportunity to get out and about. It was at Odeum that I took a long trip on a Chinook to Italy, to Naples and back. And that was where I had the experience of a near mid-air collision. That was interesting.
You say that mid-air collision was interesting.
Oh, yeah, it was, yeah. See, it's funny, it's another thing, the way my mind works. And like having the gun stuck in my face in Moscow and stuff like that, it didn't bother me.
That was actually, weirdly, a road rage incident, wasn't it?
Yeah,
when the gun
was,
got stuck in your face.
Absolutely.
And just interested in hearing from your experience what you think about this recent tit-for-tat expulsions of the Russian defence attaché from London and then the British attaché from Moscow.
Yeah. Well, I was quite interested in the terminology used, you know, with Captain Coghill, I think it is, was the name of the defence attaché that was expelled from Moscow, saying he was an undeclared intelligence officer. Well, you know, everybody, as I said previously, everybody knew what everybody was up to at certain times, you know, what their roles would have to be at certain times. And although you were ostensibly smoothing relations and so on and liaising with the Russian military, they knew that we had another role. And that applied to all the members of the of staff of the defense section. They knew that, and similarly, we know that these guys are operating, and in our country.
So, I just want to finish. I mean, you mentioned a couple of times about the kind of driving conditions when you're in Moscow, and how hairy it was, one incident in particular, which is really strange.
This is bizarre. I have to pinch myself sometimes. I know it happened. It was just. I went down one Saturday, it was a Saturday morning, I went down to the embassy to collect some mail. The Moscow River's right there, the Kremlin's on the other side of the river. Pick the mail up, and as I'm driving away, on the other side of the road, the pavement on the other side of the road, nearest the river, I suddenly see this bear walking on its hind legs, waving its paws about in the air. And it was just, I couldn't quite take it because I couldn't see a handler or anything. There was nobody near, unless the guy had jumped in the river. I don't know where he could possibly have been, but there was.
So what'd you do?
I carried on driving and just shook my head. You know, only in Russia. Brilliant.
Just another day in Moscow, hey?
I miss the place. Honestly, I do. I had a great time there. Enjoyed it.
Mike Mutter, it's been so good talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Mike's book, Spying on the Kremlin, is out now. Mike, a lot has changed since he was in Moscow, hasn't it? A technological revolution, diplomatic relationships have gone through huge swings. Has espionage changed much in that time, though?
Well, it has in some respects and not in others. So it's much more about open source intelligence now. And all the intelligence professionals here in the West will tell you that 90% of what they need is now open source material. It's a question of bringing it all together. That's the challenge. But the 10% that you still need secret intelligence for, human intelligence, when you need it, nothing else will do. And even if it's only 5% or 3%, you've still got to have it. And they'll also tell you that in Britain, the Russian effort in Britain never diminished at the end of the Cold War in terms of the numbers of people they had and what they were doing. There's still a traditional element to all of that because it is a game of cowboys and Indians. You're trying to actually find, you get your people on the ground and you're trying to stop them getting their people on the ground. And so it still is a world of tradecraft, which involves bugs and listening devices, dead letter drops. Trying to work out if somebody is turnable, if they could defect, if you can sort of work your way into their circle and see if what you can find out. There's still a lot of that going on. One of the things that has changed most interestingly that I've talked to some of the intelligence professionals about is how they subcontract the work. They used to subcontract during the Cold War. The Russians always subcontracted to the Bulgarians and to the Czech intelligence services. And I've often asked people, do they use different subcontractors now? And they said, no, they don't. They still don't trust. They wouldn't subcontract to Cuba or to Venezuela or anything like that. But they really subcontract to criminal groups. They really work much more than they ever did before with criminal gangs. And the Russians are very skilled at doing that. And again, it sort of emphasizes one of the things I worry about is that we are, as I've argued many times, you know, we're falling into a world dominated by dictatorship and gangsterism. And this, I think, is another symptom of the way we're slipping towards that world of dictatorship and gangsterism.
And Micah, got any honey trap stories you want to share with us?
Not just at the moment.
That'll be for another day, hey? Yes. Mike, really great to have you. So, thanks very much to you and to all of our guests. And that is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another Sit Rep next Thursday. Until then, you can always catch up with past programmes you might have missed online at bfbs.com/sitrep, the Forces News YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.